Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is the writer David Almond. Most of his work is for children, but the adults who populate the juries of heavyweight literary prizes really like it too. The accolades began with his first novel, Skellig, published in 1998 when he was 47. It won the weighty Whitbread Children's Award and then many others besides. Ever since, he's been acclaimed for his ability to craft complex philosophical narratives with strikingly down-to-earth characterisations. He grew up on Tyneside in a big Catholic family, and the influences of his childhood feature heavily in his stories. He says, "Each of my books has had to be written. There was something that had to come out." And I'm wondering in that phrase, David Almond, whether that means there is a sort of catharsis when you write.
I think there is some kind of catharsis. I think if you're driven to write, it's because there's something inside you that's driven to be written, that wants to get out and to be written. So I know I'm writing well when I feel I'm writing from some kind of need, that there's an urgency to get something out. It's almost like I'm not inventing something, but that something is kind of weirdly inventing me or inventing itself on the paper in front of me.
And what about the age I mentioned just there? You were 47 when this first big book, Skellig, was published, a great acclaim. You had been writing at that point for 2 decades. Did it come as something of a relief?
Yeah, I'd been writing forever. And when Skellig came out, I waited for the reviews that said, "Here's this new writer." And then the review that said, "Overnight success." And I said, "Yeah, and it's only taken 20 years.
Yeah.
So it did come as a kind of relief. But also, there's part of me that didn't care. And I think that's important. There's got to be a part of it that really doesn't give a damn. There's another part that thinks I'm the best thing that's ever happened and waits for acclaim. But the central thing just does the work.
The fact that each of your books had to be written then, do you think if you'd never been published and never met with the considerable success you have, you'd still be at home writing whilst you were working, doing something else to pay the bills?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, for those 2 decades before Skellig came out, I was a part-time teacher. But also I was writing and I made nothing from it. And I had an audience of about 25 people who thought I was really good, and that was fine.
And when you walk into a room now, I mean, you came in today to our control room here in the studio, you know, and a variety of your books were lying around the room. Mm. Do you still get a little thrill when you see your books populating the world?
It's great to walk in anywhere and see books with my name on, because what a writer wants is to get their work out into the world. It stops being them and it goes away and becomes something else for other people.
Let's go to the music. Tell me about your first one of the morning then. What is it?
This is from L'Orfeo by Monteverdi, who I discovered when I was a late teenager, I think, going to the library in Gateshead. They had a fantastic stock of LPs at the time, and I just loved Monteverdi. I loved this passage from L'Orfeo. It's when Orpheus is going down into the underworld to find his lost Eurydice, and he has to persuade Charon to let him through. So how does he do it? By singing beautifully.
Possente Spirto from L'Orfeo by Monteverdi, performed by Anthony Rolfe Johnson and the English Baroque soloist conducted there by John Elliot Gardner. So, David Almond, writing for children. People can get a bit touchy about it because, of course, we don't regard things that are written for children as highly as we regard things that are written for grown-ups.
That's right. For years I thought, oh, I'm an intelligent, educated adult, so I should be writing books for intelligent, educated adults. And I was kind of ambushed by this children's book, Skellig. And as soon as I began to write it down, I just felt liberated. I thought, oh, yeah, you know, there is this new world in which I can write. And books that are written, you know, apparently for children are works of art. And it's also, you know, where else is our culture going to be regenerated except through young people and through art for young people?
You've said that you didn't want to be known as a northern writer.
If you grew up in the north as I did and you say, I'm a writer, in that kind of accent, then people say, oh, I know what you write about, you know, and they kind of try to categorise you immediately. And so I spent a long time trying not to be a northern writer, to write about something that I kind of knew nothing about. And it was only when I turned back and allowed myself to write with northern rhythms and about northern culture and to draw on the fantastic kind of landscape and character of the north that I became a better writer.
For many years, how you earned your living was as a teacher. You've been very forthright in your views about education, you know, talking a lot about the restrictiveness of the curriculum and things that are driven by outcomes just not being conducive to a proper, thorough education for children.
I think there's always a conflict in education between the need for creativity and the need for kind of mechanical structures. And I think often the swing goes back the wrong way. It becomes just too mechanistic and too formulaic. I think we're going through a period like that now. But at the heart of it is children and teachers. And I think, you know, children and teachers themselves are creative beings who can't be confined. It was interesting when I wrote Skellig, I found myself writing about education. And Mina in Skellig quotes William Blake, "How can a bird that is born for joy sit in a cage and sing?" Which is, you know, such a great line. And I think if we try to constrict people too much, we'll stop them learning.
You got into, it was a sort of minor dust-up with the then Education Secretary, David Blunkett. Were you surprised that suddenly you were looked upon as somebody who had a point of view that wasn't helpful to education?
It was, on the one hand, it was really surprising because I said 10% of the curriculum needs to be just left as kind of space, as dream time, which seemed to me quite a sensible kind of proposal. And I was attacked and they said that this is a free-for-all, anything-goes kind of philosophy which will destroy a whole generation of children. And I thought, this is bonkers. You know, how can people believe this? I'd been a teacher by that time for 20 years. I'd just won the major children's book prize in this country. And the only way they could take me seriously was by attacking me, by kicking out at me. I think there's this fear in English education, especially when it becomes attached to politics, of feeling soft.
Yes, the woolly liberalism argument.
Yeah, they think it's really soft, and it's not. You know, it's like the way I write my books appears to be free-for-all, anything goes, because at the beginning it is. But I'm incredibly disciplined. I have a really tight routine. I work really hard. This is how things are made, by a kind of a match of playfulness and discipline.
Let's have your second disc of the morning. Tell me about this.
This is Doris Day. When I think back to my childhood, when I was 5, 6, 7, the voice I hear is Doris Day. I grew up in a little pebbledashed estate in Felling, and I can hear Doris singing the Black Hills of Dakota.
Take me back to the Black Hills, the Black Hills of Dakota, to the beautiful Indian country that I love. Lost my heart in the Black Hills, the Black Hills of Dakota.
The Black Hills of Dakota, sung there by Doris Day, of course. And so this pebble dash that you were born into then, you were one of six. Could only have been a big lively household with six kids.
Yeah, it was a small house, but there were several of us in there. And it was a newly built pebbledashed estate down at the bottom of Felling. We'd moved there from an upstairs Tyneside flat, which was riddled with mice and, you know, had a toilet in the backyard, things like that.
So it felt like progress. That was a nice thing, to move to a new estate that had better facilities, wasn't it?
It was, because things were being built. It was, you know, not long after the war, and I remember a great sense of optimism. I know my dad, you know, my dad said, you can be anything. You can do absolutely anything, you kids.
Your father had fought in Burma. Did he ever talk to you about that?
He didn't much. He died when I was very young. He died when I was 15. We never really had a good conversation about Burma. He seemed not to want to talk about it, which I think was typical of a lot of people who went there.
Yes. And what about your mother then?
From a very young age, my mum had terrible arthritis. So all the time I remember, she was very damaged by this awful disease. You know, her fingers, her hands, her knees, her joints. But she had this incredible spirit and joy. You know, she was a very joyful, happy woman.
And you say your father died when you were 15 and you were one of six. That's a very difficult set of circumstances.
You think about it afterwards. I mean, my baby sister died when I was very young, and then my dad died. Two of my sisters were very small, 2 and 3 at the time. And my mum brought us up, and weirdly, I didn't think about it until I was in my 20s. Look what she did.
Yes.
How did she manage to do that?
Yes. It was your little sister who died?
My little sister, yeah. She died when I was 7. She was 1. She'd had a bad chest, as lots of kids did then, and I'm sure maybe these days she would have been fine.
And what do you remember about that time?
It was terrible, because we were there, you know. There were 3 of us there when Barbara, she didn't wake up one morning, and we saw Barbara in my mum's arms, and it was like hell. It was like hell in this little house for that morning.
Most people are lucky enough not to touch those sort of tragedies in their life, and I'm wondering, when you went on to have your own daughter, did that have a sense of vulnerability about it, because you'd witnessed something as sad as that?
With her, I didn't. But I think what it does do, if you sort of lose people when you're very young, is that it makes the whole world seem very fragile.
At the centre of Skellig is the story of this little baby who's very vulnerable and who has a heart condition and is in and out of hospital, and at one point, you know, things are looking very, very bad indeed. Did that feel like you were writing it out, like you were writing about Barbara, when you were able to put down something as intimate as that in your book?
I couldn't allow myself to think too much about that, because I think if I'd thought too much about it, then it would have directed me into different kind of emotional impact and saying, oh, it's terrible, isn't it terrible, isn't it terrible? Yeah. Whereas as a writer, you have to distance yourself from your material, no matter how personal it is. So you distance yourself, you make it into something, you know, you try to make it into something beautiful, into a work of art.
Is there any sense in which you are cautious about exploiting something that, you know, that was not just your experience, of course, it was the experience of your entire family, of your brothers and sisters, of your mother?
Absolutely, and that gives you a kind of responsibility to the material, that you're not just going to use to exploit it. So you have to use it in a way that honours the experience and also honours the other people who were attached to the experience as well.
Let's have some music then, David Armand. What are we going to hear now?
La Bohème was the first opera that I ever saw on stage. I think it's a great way to start watching opera, because it was just so fantastic, and especially this first section when Rodolfo and Mimi are falling in love. It's just beautiful, beautiful music.
O Suave Fanciulla from La Bohème by Puccini, performed there by Luciano Pavarotti and Mirella Freni, and the Berliner Philharmonica conducted by Herbert von Karajan. So then, David Armand, you were a voracious reader. What did you enjoy as a youngster?
I liked myths and legends, and I mean, I remember one book in particular, King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table, in a fantastic version by Roger Lancelin Green. And I can remember the feel of the book, what the cover looked like, and I remember how it cracked as it got older.
And you started writing young, as a lot of writers do. I read that you stitched what you wrote into books. Explain that to me, I don't understand.
I used to write stories on paper and then stitch the spines with needle and thread.
So making your own books.
Making them my own books, so that it looks like books, yeah.
And did you show your mum what you were writing when you were little?
I think I did, yes. And I don't know what happened to all of the stories now. Maybe they're all in somebody's attic somewhere.
And you said that your dad, in this rather democratic environment that you moved to as a young family, said to you, you know, you can do anything. Mm. You can be anything in this big world.
Yes.
Did you have the courage to think, in this big world, I can be a writer?
I did, and I think his kind of statements like that really helped me. We had a tramp who lived in our town, and I used to really admire the tramp, because he used to live at the top of the town. And I remember saying to my dad one day, I'd love to be a tramp like him. And he said, yes, that'll be fine, son, but just get educated first.
Yeah, but here's a funny thing. You didn't really, secondary school didn't really particularly work out for you, or at least not, you didn't enjoy it very much.
I didn't enjoy it. I didn't like secondary school. By the time I was about 12, 13, I suppose I became a kind of standard, you know, disaffected, apparently uninterested teenager. But I was reading voraciously at the library. We had a fantastic library. But school seemed distant. And when people say now how good schools were in the past, I want to take them back and say, well, OK, come back to some of my lessons that I had in the 60s. I think schools and teachers now are, you know, eons ahead of how they were when I was at school.
And that, of course, was at that crucial point in the 60s when everything was changing. Do you think also that had an influence, that the teachers were from that sort of post-war generation, maybe some of them even had fought and gone through the war, and there you were imagining a very different future that was very much motivated by your own self-fulfillment rather than duty and being buttoned up?
Oh, I think that's right. You know, we had a lot of stuff about moral fibre in school, and in a sense, everybody was a victim of this. Yes, a lot of the teachers had gone through war, you know, they'd retrained to become teachers, and so they were kind of struggling. And then they had these kids in the 60s who were aspiring to great things and becoming hippies, and it was difficult to be a hippie in Tyneside.
What, you couldn't get the beads? It was too cold to go.
It was too cold to wander about.
Let's have some more music then. What are we going to hear now, David?
We used to go every Monday and Thursday to the Oxford Ballroom in Newcastle and listen to Tamla. Tamla Motown was just fantastic to us. And this was the great Tamla breakthrough moment for me. It was Reach Out by the Four Tops.
That was Reach Out by the Four Tops. So, David Almond, you went to university, the first in your family, but not the last. And then you decided that initially you were going to teach. What was it about teaching that attracted you?
When I left university, I thought, I want to write. What am I going to do? So I thought, a teacher, what a great job for a writer, because you get 6 weeks holiday. I'll write during that time. So I trained to be a teacher. I did a PGCE and then became a teacher. And of course, I was so exhausted by teaching that I wrote nothing for 2 years. And also became fascinated by teaching. And I worked in a little primary school in Gateshead and was fascinated by it and loved it, really.
You say that for 2 years you didn't write anything. When did you pick the writing back up again? When did you find the time?
I'd been writing fragments. And then I kind of muscled down and began to write seriously again and began to write short stories, began to get my first stories published as I was teaching in that first sort of 5 years of teaching.
And there was a sort of crossroads, crunch time in your life. You were newly divorced, you had been teaching for an amount of time and doing enough writing and writing short stories, but it seemed it wasn't enough. You sort of threw it all in. What happened?
That's right. And I'd been teaching for these years. I'd been married, that had fallen. And I remember vividly, I opened The Guardian one morning, on a Monday morning, and there was a tiny little advert and it said, do you have a talent that you would like to pursue? Would you like to live in a mansion in East Anglia and help to rebuild the mansion and pursue your own art? And I went straight to the staff telephone, phoned the number that was there and said, yes, I would love to do that.
What year was that then?
This was 1982. Right. I went to live in this kind of commune up towards the coast in Norfolk. It was a dilapidated mansion.
Having read your work, there are a lot of Blakey and William Blake references in there, and we know that you know, he is often associated with the idea, the beginnings of that sort of free love. And
yes,
I'm thinking,
yeah,
was it a free love commune?
It wasn't that kind of free love commune. I wasn't. In fact, it was owned. His wife was an American artist, so she had this idea of a colony of artists living together and would work towards some common purpose. The common purpose was to rebuild the house.
So it was a free labour commune then?
Free labour commune. So we worked 3 days a week for the house and then had 4 days. So there were artists, writers, potters, musicians. It was magical. It was an intense experience for us all. And it was a year that seemed to last for about 7 years because so much happened. It was so great.
How did it change you?
It changed me because it gave me, again, that sense of possibility. It was like a year of dream time inside my own life when I really began to write well, when I began to open up. Maybe I became a bit of the hippie that I couldn't be in Tyneside in the 60s. And I met my partner, Sarah Jane, there. We fell in love. And it was just, it was a great, great time. We had no money, hardly anything at all.
Yes, how did you survive? I mean, how did you buy food?
Well, before I'd gone, I sold the house. So I used that money to last for a year. And I think
how much?
I think I had about £1,300.
And did it work, the commune? I mean, did people exchanging their labour for the time to be creative and try to live out their creative dreams, did that all shake down well?
It worked for that year. But I think if you're going to rebuild a 17th century mansion, it's probably not a great idea to have writers and musicians putting the roof on.
Let's have some more music then, David. What are we going to hear now? We're on your fifth of the morning.
This is the Adagio for Strings by Samuel Barber, and this is the soundtrack of Gunthorpe, which is where we were, North Norfolk. I can just hear this and I see the summer in that hall, see the big gardens, the lake, the forest, and cycling up towards the sea and just having a lovely time.
The Adagio for Strings by Samuel Barber, performed by the New York Philharmonic, conducted by Leonard Bernstein. So, David Almond, you left the commune and you left it with your new love. Did you feel a sense of a sort of trepidation that you could go out into the world and actually survive it together?
I guess so, but also, you know, we needed money. We had no money. And we went to live in a farmhouse in Suffolk for a very cold winter and lived on the dole, so we were on the dole for a while. And then came back to the northeast, and I ended up going back into teaching to earn some money, but with this increased drive to write and to keep on writing, and this was now pushing forward very strongly.
You wrote a collection of short stories called Counting Stars around about that time. You've described that as a breakthrough. Why?
Weirdly, I began writing Counting Stars when I was in that farmhouse in Suffolk, and I wrote a story called Where Your Wings Were, which was about Barbara, about my sister. And I read it and I hated it because it seemed too kind of sentimental and too personal to me. So I put it away in a drawer and wrote other things. And then I took it out of the drawer again. And it just generated this whole series of stories called Counting Stars, which drew on my own childhood. And it was the first time I kind of turned back and said, oh, right, I'm from the North, I'm a Catholic, and just allowed those things into my work. And as soon as I allowed them to really influence me, there was a whole kind of font of rhythm and imagery and character and language that I could draw on that I allowed to inform my work. And the first time I did it was in Counting Stars.
We've talked a lot about Skellig. It is a highly emotional book. What were you like when you were writing it?
With Skellig, it did seem to write itself. It was weird. And at times I almost had to write it sort of from the side of my eye. You know, I couldn't look at it too closely. So I almost had to just not ignore it, but just allow it to happen there. It was such a strange book to write. And
has that happened with other... I mean, you've written many, many other books that have been very successful too. Has that happened with them?
Not to the same extent. No. Skellig, the whole of Skellig was like that.
Now, it is a book with that toys with spirituality, that looks at it with that kind of sideways glance. I don't want to get too airy-fairy, but did you at times wonder if somebody was working through you? Did you sometimes feel that there was a spirit that had a lot to do with the writing of that book?
Well, I kind of couldn't believe that, because I don't believe that. But it felt like that. And also, it felt more like I'd entered a space where this stuff was happening anyway. And I was allowed access to it for a time. And it sounds madly mystical, but it's not. There is a sense that when you're writing well, and it also came when I began to write for children, that there's a kind of world of myth and story which is kind of just beside us. And at times you're kind of allowed access to it.
Let's have some more music. What are we going to hear now?
We're now having... this is the Opera of Skellig. Skellig became a play, and it was a radio play, and there were moves to make it into a movie. And then Todd McOver, the American composer, came and said, how about if we made an opera of Skellig? And it seemed just so perfect for me.
And you wrote the libretto?
I wrote the libretto.
And how was that? How did you know what to do?
I didn't, because I remember sitting across the table from Todd, and he said, David, I'd like you to write the libretto as well. And I took a deep breath and I said, yes, of course I can do that, Todd.
Part of Skellig the Opera, written by Todd McOver and my castaway, David Almond, performed there by Matthew Long, Merin Lezan and Omar Ibrahim, with the Northern Symphonia recorded at the Sage in Gateshead. We've talked a lot then, David Almond, about 1998 being a significant year for you, what with the huge success of Skellig, but actually the most important thing that happened to you that year is that your only daughter was born. Freya came into your life. Tell me about that.
It was wonderful. And she was born, I think, about 5 months before Skellig was published, and Skellig was waiting on the printing machines ready to go, but they were just waiting for the dedication. So one of the first jobs I had when Freya was born and named, that I had to phone the publishers up and say, well, she's called Freya Grace, so this can be the dedication to Freya Grace.
And having your own child and writing for a younger audience, are the, you know, the two things must surely be related. You must have looked throughout the years at how she responds to literature and creativity and ideas and humour and used that.
Yeah, and watching her grow up and using books with her really confirmed my belief in children's literature, because I learned so much about reading and writing from using picture books with her. You know, if you watch your child reading a picture book, you read, you understand why pages matter, because you turn the page, oh yes, and then the next page, and there's a great moment of discovery and excitement, and then the next page comes. Oh. So you really get the sense that a book is a series of secrets exposed, of discoveries.
What does she think of your books when they come out then? Does she give you a little critique?
She doesn't critique them, she reads them, and but then it's just me dad, you know. But what did happen was when she was four, and I thought, well, oh, I can't really be a children's writer and have a daughter and not write a picture book. So I wrote a picture book when she was four. And then when she was eight, she went through this process of, you know, when kids are growing up and we think, oh, they're grown up now, so they need to leave pictures behind, which I think is balmy. You know, why should children? And people see books without pictures as being somehow more grown up. And I think that's just mad. So I wrote a book with pictures in it called My Dad's a Birdman, and then went on to write more because I think that's important.
What about the problem of, well, with musicians we call it second album syndrome. You know, you've had this first great hit and you've said so much and people have loved you for it, and then everybody's waiting for the second album to come out, in your case the second book. Did you feel worried about that after Skellig, about the fact that you maybe couldn't live up to what you just produced?
Well, by the time Skellig was taken, I'd been writing for all these years and working really hard, and I knew the important thing was just to get the next book done. So that between acceptance and publication, there was over a year. And on the one hand, I thought, oh, no, that's too long. But then I thought, well, I'll just write the next book. So I wrote the next book in that space, and the next book was Kit's Wilderness, which, in fact, as a writer, I think is a much better book than Skellig is.
You went on a couple of years ago to write a book where Mina was the central character, and for anybody who's a fan of Skellig, they will know, of course, that she plays a very important role in the book Skellig. She has lost a parent, and she pretends to people that she, you know, doesn't remember her father, and she her father died before she was born. But of course, this is not the case, and I'm wondering if how much you drew on the resource of losing your father when you were relatively young.
I think I did. I think I obviously did. But again, it was a case where I couldn't think about that too much. And writing My Name is Mina was a great experience, because when you're writing, you can become someone else. You know, I wasn't David Almond. I was Mina. You know, the book is called My Name is Mina. So weirdly, you know, I'm obviously not an adolescent girl, but I felt like Mina when I was writing the book. And when you take on a character and write from their point of view, they release something about you that you didn't know was there. So she allowed me to write in a very Mina-ish way, in a way I wouldn't have been able to write as David Almond. It sounds daft.
Let's have some more music then, David Almond. We're going to hear what now?
This is Bach Goldberg Variations, which we played when our daughter was being born.
That was the first variation from Bach's Goldberg Variations performed by Glenn Gould. So you're writing for adults now as well, The True Tale of the Monster Billy Dean.
Hmm.
Why?
Billy had been pestering me for years, and it was like a voice in my head that kept jabbering away. And so when I finished Mina, I said, right, now is the time to allow Billy to come to the front. And then Billy began to write his story. And I wanted to write a story that was totally misspelt, because it's a book written by somebody who can't write. He's learning to write. He's learning how to shape stories in the process of doing it, which seems to me is what we do as we grow up. So it's a book that's told in Billy's voice. It's a kind of, it's phonetically spelt. But in some ways, it feels like, it was published for adults. It feels like a natural development of the work that I've been doing for children anyway. And it's not as if I said, oh, I've got to somehow, write something really special for adults. No. It just felt like another book.
You have said that one of the important parts of the creative process is being disciplined. So you're disciplined, are you, about how your day is? Are you one of those writers who says, 3 hours before breakfast, 2 hours in the morning, blah, blah, blah? Mm. How do you structure your writing
not
day?
Not much before breakfast.
Oh, OK.
I am. I work from 9:30 until 5 when I'm at home writing. Often I go into a library. I go into a great library called the Lytton Firle in Newcastle, which is a fantastic place, and I go and sit there, or I sit in my shed at home. But it's important just to sit down. Routine is really important. So while the creative process looks very loose and free, it can only work well within a structure.
You said earlier that you, much to your surprise, you did get bitten by the bug as a teacher. You found out that the children mattered to you and the whole process mattered to you. Writing, of course, is, by its very nature, a solitary thing. Mm. Do you still make sure that you get a little fix of the classroom now and again? Do you go out and talk to children?
Oh, I do, and I go to schools. I was in schools 2 days ago, and just fantastic, children who get such a terrible press. We have great children in this country. I work in universities. I'm a professor of creative writing now at Bath Spa, and I teach adults, I teach students, I teach children. Creativity and the imagination are central to us all.
How are you going to be on the island? You'll be alone, of course.
I think I'll be okay. I think being a Catholic, there's a part of me which is always kind of tempted towards living in the wilderness, or being... I'm a great admirer of St Cuthbert, who lived on Lindisfarne and then moved to another island to be totally on his own when all he could see were the stars in heaven. So I think I might manage for a while, but I think I'd get bored and a bit lonely. Yeah.
Let's have your final piece then. What are we going to hear now?
The final piece is Natalie Merchant, who I really like. She's a wonderful singer and songwriter. And this is her singing Which Side Are You On?, which seems to me it's a kind of a protest song from the 30s America. And it seems, people are singing these songs again when the poor are yet again being made to pay for the wickedness of the rich.
Come all you good workers, good news to you I'll tell, of how the good old union has come in here to dwell. Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on?
Which Side Are You On by Natalie Merchant. So, David, we are going to now give you the books, the Bible, the complete works of Shakespeare, and you get to take another book along to the island. What's it going to be?
It would be The 1001 Nights. I think just such a great fund of stories. And I thought about taking a novel, but you can't read a novel 25 times. So 1001 Nights, which is just filled with energy and all kinds of stories and characters. Fantastic.
Right, it's yours. And you're allowed a luxury too. What will your luxury be?
It would have to be notebooks. I've just come back from Japan. I love Japan. And I love Japanese notebooks, those lovely, soft-covered, beautifully designed notebooks, and some pens. And I think I'd draw as well as write, and maybe invent a new alphabet.
Right, OK, those are yours then. And you're allowed to save a disc from the waves. Which one will you save?
The one I'd save, it would have to be Monteverdi, L'Orfeo. Fantastic.
Right, it's yours, David Almond. Thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you very much. It's been great.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website. bbc.co.uk/radio4.